And we're back here at Club 30. We're sitting in Midtown, New York City. Jay, how we doing?
We're doing good, Hanky. You know, lots of stuff going on. Obviously, the new year brings new challenges. But yeah, no, it's been great.
So a few months ago, I went out to Aspen for a charity event, a local kids hockey program. And my plan was to ski and maybe some snowmobiling, play a hockey game.
Absolutely.
And I was surprised with a fighter jet experience, which was unbelievable. You know, as a kid, I always wondered, even as an adult, sure. I always wondered, how is it to sit in a fighter jet?
And
it was such a cool experience.
Wait, so how did that come about? You walked out the door and there's a fighter jet waiting? Or?
So we had a cocktail event and this guy comes up to me and he just looked at me. He's like, tomorrow we're going up in a fighter jet. And I thought he was joking. So that night we had a couple of drinks, we had great stories. And the next day we were going up, flying through the mountains up in Aspen, Colorado.
Wow.
And the pilot, Matthew Wiz Buckley, he's here today. You know, I'm so curious about flying, being a pilot, but even more so a fighter jet pilot.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of questions.
Yeah. Every kid's dream, including mine as well. You know, that's probably why I became an aerospace engineer. It's just my love of, you know, watching things when you're kids. Like, you remember the first time you saw Top Gun, right? Like, that was the inspiration for probably hundreds of thousands
and
of
watching
kids.
The second Top Gun even yeah. more now I want to be up in a jet.
Totally. Well, first, I'm really jealous because that's been on my bucket list for a long time, but this is going to be cool just to dig in on what it takes to not only become a pilot, which I know is very challenging. I have a few hours myself, but it's a big commitment to get even your private pilot's license, but then to be like the best of the best, a Top Gun graduate, right? It's yeah. crazy.
You know, my biggest goal was not to pass out. And also before I went up,
yeah.
my wife told me, it's like, you are not going up in that plane unless you call your heart doctor.
Oh, right.
So that was step one. I had to clear the fact that I could handle four or five G's. So that was step one in this. So I called them and maybe I said, we're going to maybe push 3-4 G's.
Right.
But we went all over that.
Well, save it. I want to hear about Wiz's take when he's here. And I'm excited to have him here because, you know, obviously his stories are going to be really interesting. Mm-hmm. And two, he's not from New York City, right? So we have the advantage over him in that we're now locals. So excited to hear what his reactions to flying into New York City in the winter are. Mm-hmm. But on the New York thing, I know you oftentimes have friends and fellow Swedes and folks visiting. What is like your go-to New York experience for them when somebody's in from out of town? And you have to be involved.
I have to be involved?
Yeah.
Then I would spend the day in the West Village, probably.
Nice.
Or Soho. I feel like you sit down for a nice lunch yeah. and then you can walk around without being too stressed.
Yeah.
A little less traffic.
Yeah.
I would definitely book a great show. I love Broadway. There's so many talented people performing on Broadway or obviously the Garden. Mm-hmm. If the next Rangers or a concert going on there, I would end up there for sure.
Yeah.
In terms of dinner, that's the one thing I find pretty hard because there's so many good options. It depends what I'm...
Yeah.
I love Italian food.
Yeah.
What's the place we always go to? We always have great meals there.
Oh, Babbo. Yeah. That's...
They have good pasta there.
It's hard to beat Babbo. Yeah.
No, it's a great lunch. West Village or Soho. Maybe walk around. Maybe do some shopping.
Yeah.
And then focus on a really nice dinner before going to a show on Broadway or MSG.
Yeah, that sounds right. I would try to imagine if I had no responsibilities for a Saturday, you know, what would I do? And I'd bring them along to that. So I'd probably start West Village, maybe brunch somewhere, a couple cocktails. Hopefully it's nice weather. You sit outside, low key, and walk around Soho, do some shopping. If they're an athlete, I often take like some of my cycling buddies to Central Park in the morning to ride because nobody believes that the riding's really fun here. You know, and Central Park in the morning is incredible. It's just like this, you know, this little slice of, it's totally different than in every other part of the city. It's all running and cycling. And it's just a good vibe there in the morning.
The energy is incredible there.
Yeah, it's so good. And people are like, they're in disbelief that it's such a cool like route exists in the biggest city in the US. So that's cool. I would say Babbo or Carbone for a scene or maybe Pastis, mm-hmm. which is still like a fun, lively thing. And then if they want to do something more touristy, I'll definitely throw them on the bus, you know, that's just so they can see it, but I won't be joining.
I won't be joining.
Yeah. All right. Well,
Well, let's ask what, let's ask what he's been up
to. And what he wants to do.
So let's bring him on the show here.
Yeah, can't wait. Going.
He's a Navy fighter pilot and a graduate of Top Gun. He's flown in over 40 combat missions, and today he spends a lot of his time helping veterans and first responders with mental health through his foundation, No Fallen Heroes. Please welcome Club 30's first supersonic guest, Matthew Wiss Buckley.
Thanks, bro. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome to have you here.
Honored.
Yeah, we got into it a little bit during the intro here. We met a few months ago in Aspen.
Yeah.
And you took me on. Such a great experience.
You bet. You did great too, man. You were a G monster. Most people don't do as well as you did.
And that was my goal, to not pass out.
To not embarrass yourself?
How often is that people actually pass out up there?
Oh my God, man. There are people who, when I close the canopy to that fighter jet, they're done. They're like, nope, I'm good.
Really?
Or, yeah. Oh yeah. No. In the brief, he's a little nervous. I could tell he was a little nervous, but he has that smile on his face. He's like, and then once we got airborne, he was a natural.
Yeah.
Because we do a G-warm, right? Before you work out, you know, you stretch.
Sure.
So before we pull Gs in a fighter jet, we do what's called a G-warm. So if they don't freak out when the canopy closes, I lose most people at the G-warm, right? Because we accelerated to about, I don't know, 300, 350 knots and pulled 4 Gs. So 4 times the force of gravity. And he was hanging. So I step it up from there. After he made it through the G-warm, I'm like, all right, let's do a little aerobatics. And I briefed him to take the jet too. You did an aileron roll. Right?
Oh, yeah. I got to fly myself. Sweet. It was unreal. But talking about being nervous, when I get there, my pulse was good. And no, I was feeling really good about it. And then we had the safety briefing.
Correct.
That's when it started to get real for me. When you told me, it's like, okay, we really have to talk about this in case it happens and we have to eject.
That's like, when shit got real.
and when you told me, I'm going to count to 3.
Yeah.
And after 3, you're on your own.
You'd be on your first solo flight.
Yeah. And after you said that, I'm like, this just became very real to me. Okay. Correct. If this happens.
2-seat fighter jet. It was used as a light attack jet for some Warsaw Pact countries. But here in the U.S., we use it as a
trainer.
And to go have fun.
Cool.
But since it's a single engine fighter jet, that thing stops turning. You're kind of out of options. So it does have live ejection seats. So I have to give a thorough brief that says, hey, man.
Was Hank flipping through the manual?
Nervous. Or, you know, God forbid if, you know, because we were doing some low altitude flying. If I took a bird in the face and I'm done for, I'm like, dude, don't worry about me. Save yourself. So that's when he started, that little bit of a smile started to go away from his face.
And then, okay, we're taking off. We're going out towards the runway. And in the safety briefing, you told me about if we have to eject, you just pull this handle between your legs. So going out to the runway, I see 3 handles. So in my head, it's like, which one is it? Should I ask him?
Should I ask him?
I don't want to sound stupid here. Right. And at first, I was like, I'm not going to ask him. And we got really close to takeoff. I was like, Wiss, I have one question.
Got
to
do it.
Is it 2 handles between on each side? It's like, no. It's the handle between your legs. Yeah. That's the one you're pulling. So after that, I calmed down a little bit.
You got it. Yeah.
No
stupid. 2 big red handles here. But he did great. So we did the G warm up and then I gave him the jet to do some aileron rolls.
Yeah.
And most people, when I say slam the stick to the right or to the left, most people don't. They do it slow, right? And then
you start to drift. Now we're upside altitude. Down.
Yeah. We're going
to
do this. But he gave it a good slam. And we did good, man.
Nice work.
But how many times have you been flying up? Because you're stationed down in Florida. That's where you live.
Boca Raton, God's waiting room.
Yeah. So was this the first time flying up in Aspen?
First time we'd taken the jet up to Aspen because Sheldon and Colorado Extreme had the NHL alumni game. Alumni game. So make it a joint fundraiser because Sheldon and his team do a great job with Colorado Extreme. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, man, bring the jet up and we'll try and raise some money for the No Fallen Heroes Foundation.
How long did it take you to take the jet
from the range of the Albatross?
That was like 7 legs out.
Wow.
And about...
Is that kind of fun, though? You can just fly and... Like commuting in a fighter, is that...
No.
It's not perfect, right?
Well, so first of all, you know, I flew the F-18 Hornet for the Navy.
Yeah.
So going from flying that, it's like going from a Lamborghini, and what we flew in is like a scooter. Yeah. It's like, you know, you going to play U-16 or something. You know? Right. Like, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun to maybe put on the skates, but after that... So it was work getting out there.
Yeah.
And you felt that ejection seat, right? I mean, it's not an airline seat. Because think about it. If you had a cushion, if you had to eject, instantaneously that cushion would be compressed and it would break your leg. So it has to be a flat, hard surface. So imagine 8 hours on that thing.
Right.
I got a 1 hour rear end in that jet. So stopping to get gas and stretch your legs.
Yeah. What is a leg? 2 hours or an hour and a half? Or
about an hour and a half. Yeah. I can't. Yeah. It's painful. Yeah. I think the longest mission I did in the Hornet over southern Iraq was about 8.5-ish hours. Oof. And it was brutal because you're doing an hour on one cheek, doing an hour on another cheek. Right. You inflate your G suit, right? Uh-huh. Which helps you to help massage your legs. It's brutal. And that's refueling. I think I had to refuel like 3 or 4 times. From a tanker.
Yeah.
So stopping is okay in that jet. But yeah, that was the first time I had gone out to the mountains.
So when did we hit the highest G? I remember we did the loop.
The loop.
Was that the highest G?
Yeah, that was the highest G. The entry to the loop was about 5 to 6 Gs. So yep. If you weigh, I'll be nice, 200 pounds-ish? That's about 1,800 pounds. You weighed about 1,800 pounds. So the entry to the loop was a lot of G. But yep. Remember, over the top, it was quiet and zero G. It was a little astronautish, right? Yes. Little mm-hmm. weightless. Pulled the throttle to idle, so it was quiet too, right? Mm. So we were inverted over, Aspen, nice and quiet.
Yeah.
And then the exit from the loop was the same as the entry. So there was a lot of G at the bottom too. It kind of looks, it's not a loop, it's an egg. It's kind of like pull.
So, I didn't bring a GoPro, so I filmed with my cell phone holding it.
I was
at that point,
man.
I could not hold it because the G, it was a couple of times I tried to hold up my arm, film it.
And it was just
I had to hold with the other arm to keep my arm up. It was too heavy to hold it up.
It's a workout, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm impressed that you played later because most people take a G, I call it a G nap. Because first of all, it's adrenaline, because it was fear of the unknown. You're in a fighter jet. So they kind of have an adrenaline letdown like an hour or two after the flight. Right. They usually go home and crash or something. But he's laced it up and he's like, oh my God, this guy's he's a legend. Yeah. He was out on the ice, doing everything. I'm like, he's got to be beat.
Yeah.
He probably slept like a baby that night.
I mean, we partied all night. So it was a long day. I'm not going to lie. It was so much going on that day. But to your point was the unknown going up in a plane and also taking off was very cool. You stay.
Yeah.
How high above the runway for a little bit there?
We stayed. And so as soon as we got airborne, most airliners keep climbing nice and gentle. We got airborne and I pushed the nose over and stayed, 10, 20 feet, put the gear and the flaps up and you accelerate down the runway in a cushion of air called ground effect. So we got to the end of the runway, hauling ass, if the FAA is listening, under 250 knots.
Right.
And then we squatted the jet and went straight up. It's called a low transition.
Cool.
So that was the takeoff. So he's like, woo.
It was like right into it.
I was breathing.
You told me you have to squeeze your legs, right? Yeah. And just breathe.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was under control for the most part. It was one time I felt like I got a little lightheaded.
But did you go gray at all? Like sometimes people gray out. So if you've ever passed out, you have to admit to it. But the first thing you lose is what? Your vision.
Periphery. And
in the Hornet, we used to fight the jet on the edge of consciousness. I'd pull like 7-8 Gs and you start to gray out. You lose your vision first, but you can still talk on the radio. You can still, what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I was lightheaded. If you keep pushing it now, I might lose it. But then you kind of...
Yeah.
Slow down and I got back to 100%.
Speaking of surgeons, I hope your cardiologist isn't listening to this episode.
So I surprised him the night before.
Yeah.
I said, hey man, I'm Wiz and I'm taking you flying in a fighter jet tomorrow. And his face just dropped. He's like, I need to check with my doctor. And I saw him later. He's like, good news.
Yeah.
He did. He checked.
Yeah. My wife was all over me. It's like, you're not going up there. You need to call your doctor. I was like, and I did. And it was fine.
I was glad to hear that too, because I'm like, man, he's going to call his doc and he's going to bail.
Yeah.
And he didn't.
Well, I told him 3 Gs, maybe 4, but now we know. I could do 6 G.
He can do 5 to 6.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's impressive.
So let's get into this flying a little bit. What made you get into flying for the Navy? How did that come about? How did it start?
Yeah. So I grew up South Jersey. South Philadelphia, middle class, lower middle class, Irish Catholic family, tossed service above self, right?
Mm-hmm.
Always interested in serving my country, Jersey Shore, not the MTV one, the real one. So I love the water, love the ocean. I loved aviation. So that was kind of like a Reese's peanut butter cup of, I'm going to fly jets for the Navy. Because the Air Force, these guys and gals land on 10,000 foot runways. Hell, anybody can do that. You can do that. So aircraft carrier, night, bad weather. The first thing the president asks when anything goes wrong in this country is where's the nearest aircraft carrier? So always knew I wanted to fly jets for the Navy. And it's a pyramid, man. I'm going to date myself. But in high school, wanted to fly jets for the Navy. Paramount Pictures, Top Gun comes out. I'm like, son of a bitch. Because then everyone wanted to fly for the Navy. So I really had to try harder and study in high school and college. Jacksonville University down in Florida and got good enough grades to go to flight school. Down in Kingsville, Texas.
Okay.
And it's a pyramid. Military aviation's a pyramid because there's a lot of helicopters. There's a lot of propeller planes. There's a lot of jets. Mm-hmm. And then within jets itself, there's jets that look for submarines that jam radar. So there's a pyramid within a pyramid. You had to be really, really, really good to get fighter jets.
Yeah.
And then when I was going through, I flew the F-18 Hornet. So fighter and attack. It was the first jet built from the ground up to be multi-role, meaning we could fight our way into the target, shooting down bad guys, drop bombs, and then fight our way out, shooting more bad guys if we needed to. So it was the FA-18 Hornet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I, you know, I'll be honest. I don't know how I slipped through my career. To
it's it amazing.
How long was that process from start until the day you actually, okay, I'm going on a mission?
Like, yeah,
we're talking years?
3 years.
3 years.
3 to 4 years. It was probably 2 years to get my wings. My wings of gold as a naval aviator. So when you're training, you're flying trainer jets. And then when I got F-18s, you had to go to another training squadron to learn how to operationally employ the F-18 Hornet. So
was your first time in a cockpit at flight school?
Like, no, I got a little bit of flight time, some private flight time, because I wanted that extra edge. I'm like, I'm going to go to flight school with a little, some. And I had the right amount of civilian flight time, because if you go in with too much, the Navy's like, no, this is how we do things. If
you
go in
there, you have to unlearn all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, so guys and gals that went in with too much flight time actually, but the Navy flight training is designed to take somebody who's never even seen an airplane before and in a short amount of time, turn them into somebody who can be flying off an aircraft carrier. So the training process is pretty rigorous and cookie cutter. I think one of the guys in my initial flight school class, his first flight in a plane, he went to like the University of Montana, was from like Montana to Pensacola, Florida.
Yeah.
And he, in the same amount of time as me, got up to speed. So it's a very
pretty cool,
rigorous training program to get you up to speed.
What's the toughest part in that process? The training? Are you going through like, you sit in those machines testing the G-force?
The centrifuge.
Is that the toughest part?
All probably pretty equal, right? Yeah. The physical, you got to be in really good shape.
Yeah.
A lot of folks get pitched out due to medical. You had to have perfect vision. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, all sorts of stuff. So it's a pretty rigorous weeding out process.
Yeah.
And then ultimately you had to be able to land aboard a boat. So we'd practice hundreds and hundreds of time at the field. They actually paint an aircraft carrier runway on the runway. And the visual landing aid that's on the ship is there too. So you do hundreds of these at the field to work on your muscle memory. Turn here. This much rate of descent, do this, look out at this point. So it's muscle memory. Mm-hmm. But man, when I rolled in front of an aircraft carrier for the first time, I'm like, what the actual fuck is going on here?
Yeah, like, what?
Big
but
ship.
It's moving, right?
Oh my God, it's a massive aircraft carrier. 5,000 people awake, smoke coming out of the top. I'm like, oh my God.
Right.
It was insanity. But then, you know, a little bit of muscle memory kicks in. I don't even remember that the day I did that. It's kind of a blur. It was just because you land. You put your hook up and they're taxiing you up to the catapult to shoot you to go get more landing. So it's like,
oh wow,
you don't even have time to process what's going on.
Landing on the carrier, are you on somebody's wing that's done it before? Ooh. Or are you just you?
What if type of flight instructor would be like, I'm going to jump in the back seat of this student's cockpit? Nah, man, that's what's interesting. So they'll fly with you at the field.
Yeah.
And then it's like, good luck. If you're going to be a flaming ball of wreckage hitting the back of the carrier, it's going to be you solo.
Right.
Yeah. You solo.
Wow.
Exactly.
So how often do you fly? Like, is it every day, hours every day throughout school? And also I want to know, when you're in the Navy, you've been in over 40 missions. Do you upkeep every day or is it?
Oh yeah. There are requirements. You got to stay. It's called current. You have to be proficient. So you had so many days you had to do a landing at day and night and all sorts of stuff. And then unfortunately now with simulators, I guess fortunately or unfortunately, depends on your point of view, the fidelity is so good that they say, all right, now like half of your flight time can be in the simulator. As you know, you got to lace it up. Could you imagine going to a hockey simulator, man? I mean,
I've never tried it. So.
Yeah. So there's something to be said, as you saw, for briefing. Putting on your flight gear, going out, pulling jeans, sweating, as opposed to sitting in the air conditioning and, you know, playing with a computer. Yeah. So as time goes on, they're pulling back less and less of it is. It's all
it's
about
dollars,
the money.
Right? Same thing in motorsports now too.
Correct.
The sims are so much more cost effective to run than a race car.
That's exactly
right. But you don't get the feel through your body of the dynamic, you know, motion. So
guys and gals need to go out there, strap on the airplane, fly to be proficient.
Yeah.
So it just depends. If you're at home, this is how much flight time you're going to get. But overseas, I mean, with everything going on in the world right now, there are guys and gals on the tip of the spear that are flying their ass off in the Red Sea or, you know, in the Mediterranean supporting current combat operations.
How much do you need to know about the plane you're in? I remember going through the safety briefing again, mm-hmm. and you told me if something goes wrong, I want you to pull up the yellow book. Is it yellow? Yellow?
Yeah.
Behind the seat. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to go through the instructions. Yeah. And that made me a little nervous. Does he know, like, yeah. do I need to check this? Wait,
I need to
if
read?
We're going down, I'm not going to be able to read a book.
Yeah, it's like, this is in Swedish, right?
It's a good point, though. I'm glad you said that in case the FAA is listening. I told my backseater, because right next to your thigh, next to the ejection seat, is the emergency procedures.
Yes.
And the emergency procedures section is in red. Because I know the procedures, Hank, like the back of my hand, duh. But it's always good to say, hey, after I knock these out, dude, go to page whatever. At the top, it says engine whatever. Read that for me just to double check. So that's called crew resource management.
And Jay, with your background, just in terms of knowing how everything works, I mean, how long does that take to understand the plane? And there's so many buttons. And
I got to the point in the Hornet, probably like you with hockey, you're in the flow. You're in the zone. You can tell. I knew that airplane like the back of my hand. And about 12 jets in the squadron, you started to know that each jet and their quirks and how it moved and flew. It became an extension of my body at a certain point. You're just that much in it.
Are you talking a lot with the mechanics and giving them feedback?
Yeah. Well, the jet's a tattletale. As soon as you land, it's an electric jet. It'll data link to maintenance what's wrong. But you have a good relationship with the ground crew and stuff. But it's a team. The average age of the young sailors on the flight deck are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids running around on that flight deck. So when you watch the movie Maverick and you see the complex flight deck, those are young kids out there making that work. So it's a good team.
On the media stuff, like Top Gun and Maverick, can you even watch that stuff or is it just too painful?
So one of my best friends, Ferg, Captain Brian Ferguson, he got orders from the Navy, report to Paramount Studios. So he was the technical advisor to Maverick for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So the second one, hats off, because the actors flew. So them passing out in Maverick is them passing out. I mean, they had them fully in the jet and everything like that. Because Tom Cruise is a pilot. So he's flown for decades. But they did. They all flew. The actors flew. And it was pretty realistic. But the story was just a little much. On a good day in the United States Navy, it took an act of Congress to get an F-14 Tomcat airborne. I don't think you're landing in some second, third world country and it's fully maintenance, ready to go and armed up. I mean, I get it. You know, it's Hollywood, but it makes me cringe watching that stuff. But it helps recruiting, you know.
Sure.
And I loved it. But I'm not a fighter jet pilot. I mean.
But now that you've flown in one, you can appreciate all that more. And the pulling the G's and the guy, the kid passing out in the one. I mean, now these jets have so much technology that if you pass out and you're flying into the ground, it'll, you know, pull up, warning, warning. And if it doesn't feel a control input, it'll level the wings and climb you out. I think I lost two buddies to CFIT, controlled flight into terrain. So in the old days, when you blacked out, you just watch your buddy fly right into the desert floor, boom. But now the software will roll your wings level and save your life. So that software has actually saved a lot of people's lives now.
Do you remember most of your missions? And maybe you're not allowed to talk about the missions.
Oh, dude, I'd love to talk about them because, first of all, they were combat sorties. So I did a no-fly zone over southern Iraq. And I got to be honest, man, it was without a doubt the most boring flying I've ever done because there really was no air-to-air threat. Saddam, you know, he had a no-fly zone. And so it was the toughest part of my mission, my, quote, combat sorties, was landing back aboard the boat. They did a study in Vietnam of naval aviators, and they kind of wired them up and monitored their heart rate. And they'd be getting shot at by surface-to-air missiles or AAA anti-aircraft artillery or fighting MiGs, and their heart rate was kind of like this. Landing aboard the ship, it was through the roof. I mean, I'd be flying a night mission over Iraq, no fly zone mission. And as soon as I got airborne, the only thing I was thinking about was having to land back aboard the boat.
Wow.
But I'm thinking of like being in the Navy or in the Army versus team sport, the brotherhood, you know, working together. I remember going up to West Point with the Rangers, my rookie year. Oh yeah. We went out for team building. And what I always loved with these, you know, exercises we did up there, there was so much focus on the team, on trust, on accountability, and to see what you guys go through. And I'm sure accountability is so important. I mean, we talk about it. It was my favorite word, being in the locker room, accountability. But when you look at people in the Army, in the Navy, accountability, without it, I'm sure it's going to be a short mission, right? So, well, so can you talk to the, about that for people that haven't been in the Army or play team sports? Like the brotherhood you create being in the Navy.
So the accountability starts with you. mm-hmm. right? You got to hold yourself more accountable. Don't you dare let anybody hold you more accountable. So I got to fly with the Blue Angels one time when my buddy Intake was on the team. We do what's called a debrief, right? So 45 minutes to the second after we land, after our wheels touch, we get into a room like this. We take the name tag off the shoulders and the rank off the chest, and we hold what's called a debrief. And we are brutal. If you were an external observer, you'd think we hate each other. We absolutely love each other. That's why we are like this, right? You know, in a Blue Angel debrief, you get to go around the room and do an I. You lead with I. You don't get into a debrief and go, hey, Hank, man, I saw you screw this up on the mission.
Yeah.
No. First of all, Hank gets the opportunity to self-identify. Like, hey, guys, you know, on this flight, I was, you know, 1,000 feet off altitude and my formation sucked.
Yeah.
What do you have for me?
Yeah.
So what's that do? That kind of lowers the barriers to communication. And especially at the end of every Blue Angel debrief, they have a little sentence at the end of it that says, I'll fix all those things. Glad to be here. So it's kind of a reinforcement like, hey, I acknowledge my mistakes. I'm going to fix those things. And man, I couldn't be happier to be here. Thanks That's for cool. having me.
Yeah.
And it's so much focus on the team. And I remember exercise we had, we were supposed to get over the swamp and we had military guys shooting at us with paintball guns, but it was still nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So we had to get over the swamp to rescue a pilot. That was our mission as a team. And I remember our star, Jaromir Jagr, he probably weighed in at 240. He got stuck in the swamp. So we had to help him get out of the swamp.
Right.
Because everybody was just sinking. The heavier you were, the tougher it was to get across. It was like mud. I remember just getting across and working as a group. Every exercise we did up there at West Point was awesome.
Did you find it translated to the locker room? Like to Wiz's point, like that accountability and that ability to give really candid feedback first by owning up to individual. Did you see it?
Everything we experienced up there just enhanced everything we were looking to accomplish as a team. And I always felt that throughout the year too. The closer we got to playoffs, the tighter you became as a group because it was less focus on individuals, on playing time or points. And suddenly it just, the only goal that matters was, okay, we need to win the game and we need to do it together. Yeah. And it became so clear that you could feel that difference in the locker room too, the closer, especially going into the playoffs.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's one of my favorite times of the year, playing in the playoff games because you really feel like a team.
It
was awesome.
You're in that flow state. You can't be an individual in your sport or in our sport. I mean, airborne, if we were in a three ship, we'd all have different radar search responsibilities. Like you're looking low, I'm medium, you're looking high. So we're trusting the other two guys like, hey,
you're doing
a good job sanitizing your airspace. Because if you don't, you can get us all killed. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have that trust, we're not a high performing team.
Right.
I mean, you've been active in the Navy for so long now. You're helping a lot of veterans, first responders, through your foundation, No Fallen Heroes. Can you talk to us and our listeners a little bit how that started and where you're at right now?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, grew up in South Jersey and lost a sister to a drunk driver when she was 19. She went to Villanova with my brother and my other sister. And I was kind of a hand grenade in the middle of our family. I had a pretty tough childhood. And when you enter the military, it's not like you cleanse that off or something like that. So in flying 15 years, so I lost 16 brothers.
Wow.
Not one combat loss. Stupidity, weather, more stupidity, mechanical, more stupidity, weather. I mean, so not one combat loss, but still 16. It's almost, you know, if they were combat loss, you'd be able to write them off. It's like,
Rationalize.
So that was brutal. That was tough. That was a lot of trauma. I lost 3 F-18 brothers to suicide, groomsmen in my wedding. So a lot of trauma serving the country. And then I left, went to Wall Street. Going from a fighter squadron where we just talked about where you trust people with your life to an environment where you couldn't trust a dude to hold your coat for you. Mm-hmm. That was tough. That was a tough transition. So that led to a little bit of a downward spiral, man. Some alcohol, some drugs, and just some dark nights of the soul. I lost my mission, lost my sense of purpose. And then around that time, the metric that came out was 22. 22 veterans a day were taking their own lives. Wow. I'm like, that's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you stop somebody from killing themselves, especially a veteran? You know, buy him a suit, help him with a resume. I was clueless. Mm-hmm. And around that time, a buddy's like, hey, man, I know a group of SEALs veterans that go to Mexico and they do psychedelic assisted therapy. And there's a really cool group going in a couple weeks. Would you want to go? I'm like, go to Mexico and do drugs with Navy SEALs? That sounds like a great weekend, man. Sign me up.
Yeah, I'm in.
I'm in. I had absolutely no clue what I was getting in for. And I'm glad I didn't, because it was without a doubt the most transformative, life-saving and changing experience of my 52 years on the planet at that point. I went down with one of the founders of Black Rifle Coffee, another Navy SEAL veteran, and then an NFL player who was an All-American in Iowa, 8 years, I think, in the NFL, suffering from just horrific CTE. But I went down there, Hank, and my dad had died after my sister Monica had passed, and he died of a broken heart. I went to school at St. Augustine Prep in South Jersey. In between our high school, and I played sports, and so I'd miss the bus in the afternoon, and my dad would pick me up and take me home. And in between St. Augustine and our home was a cemetery, and he stopped every day, and he cried every day at that grave. So I know he died of a broken heart. I remember when I had kids, you met Matthew and Jack and Aspen, and I remember sitting with my dad, and I just kind of looked at him, I'm like, and he knew what I was talking about, because I was like, how did you do it? And he's like, I had you. And he said, you know, when they lowered her into the ground, I wanted to jump in there with her. I bring this up because on the medicine, there was my sister, and she was perfect. She was angelic. And there was my father. And I couldn't remember the last time I had seen my father smile, and he was perfect. And I felt a peace I hadn't felt in decades. And then they started to leave. You know, pixelate's a bad word, but they started to leave, and I was crying out. I'm like, don't leave. And they came back. And they kind of looked at me and they smiled. And this time I followed them and they went into everything. They went into my daughter. They went into the trees. They went into everything and they never left. They're here right now. They're here with us. There's so much more to talk about, but I came home from that retreat and I said, this is how I'm going to stop veterans from killing themselves. One of the guys, Marcus, he's like, Wiz, I was on 15 meds. 5 to wake up, 5 to go to bed, 5 for lunch. He hasn't taken a med in 4 years. We're coming up on our 4-year anniversary. I was a drinker. I don't know if you can be a good drinker. I was a bad drinker. I couldn't even look. Alcohol made me physically sick for about 8 months. It was that transformative. Mm-hmm. So I got home and I said, this is how we're going to end veteran suicide. So we started the No Fallen Heroes Foundation to help veterans and first responders. Because a lot of guys or gals get out of the military. They take this one off. And they put on a local unit or a state, but they don't unzip the trauma and leave the trauma. And then as a first responder, there's even more trauma. I had a buddy who was a 20-year Marine, and he went to Coral Gables outside of Miami Fire Rescue. He's like, Wiz, my first responder made the Marine Corps stuff look pleasant. So we help veterans, first responders, and their families.
Yeah.
Because the families serve too. Sure. So we want to help all of those groups with these medicines. And they have the potential to save and change lives. And it saved and changed mine.
Wow. The challenge right now, it's not FDA approved in the state. So you have to find different locations to treat the veterans.
Matt, so thank you, Oregon. And thank you to the great state of Colorado. You can tiptoe at a state level, but still it's federally illegal. Yeah. August, MDMA should be legal for therapeutic use in the United States. The FDA has until August, because the MDMA therapies that I've seen, they did 2 phase 3 trials, 63% in one trial, I think it was, and 71 in another trial. Mm-hmm. People with horrific PTS were clinically healed. They showed 0 signs of PTS. So to be clear, this isn't for everyone.
Sure.
There are so many healing modalities, meditation, breath work, walk on the beach, climb to a mountain in Nepal. There are a lot of healing modalities, but maybe radical trauma could use some radical healing, you know?
Sure.
This is obviously a different level, but the transition for athletes, retirement, new life, new purpose.
Yeah, man.
I mean, listening to you, it sounds like it is a big challenge for a lot of people in the Army, first responders, when you're trying to find a good place in life after serving.
A new mission.
A new mission, right?
Correct.
So is that something you talk within the Army when you're there, that the transition afterwards might be challenging or not really?
I'll be honest. They don't take care of the mind, body, and soul. It's a little bit better, but it can always be better. Because you're right. Whether it's an athlete or a veteran, you lose that sense of mission and purpose. I had a mission every day. I trusted the people I was with. Now I'm on the curb or I'm homeless or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we have close to 50,000 to 60,000 homeless veterans in this country. Like, what are we doing, man? Yeah. What are we doing? Yeah, I'm doing my best. It
sounds like you're doing amazing work.
Bro, if I don't go on one of our retreats, I'll get a text, you know, Wiz, I don't want to kill myself anymore. I mean, you can't even, you can't put a dollar on that. But, you know, when I wake up, more and more grant applications. More as the word gets out, these guys and these gals are hurting, and it's somewhat staggering. Our list is packed, man. There are other great veterans charities out there kind of aligned with us doing a similar mission. We're all looking for funding, man. We shouldn't be.
Right.
I tell people, I don't want to be doing this. What's the future of the No Fallen Heroes Foundation? I don't want it. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be doing this. Why aren't we taking care of our heroes?
Right.
Why are you know, civilians having to do this?
What keeps you going, I'm sure, maybe is having people letting you know that you're changing their lives.
Oh my God. It's humbling and it's a little overwhelming at times. Mm-hmm. The second time I sat with the medicine, I was, whatever word you want to use, I choose to use the word God. I was with that thing and I'm like, why? I'm the village idiot, man. What are we doing here? And he's like, why not? He's like, you gotta press forward, man, because it's not easy. And holding space for people at these retreats, going with some of these, because, man, to be clear, I was in 30, 40,000 feet in air conditioning. I'm country club fighter pilot type of guy. So I almost feel a little guilt that I wasn't in the shit, so to speak, and I should be helping the young women and men who really were. And they're kids, man. They're 18, 19-year-old kids.
Right. If our listeners want to help support No Fallen Heroes, what's the easiest way to be in contact with the foundation?
I appreciate that, man. NoFallenHeroes.com or go to our Instagram, No Fallen Heroes. Spread the word. I think the awareness thing's really helping. These are medicines that have been used for thousands and thousands of years. And here we are in the States, like, we need a bunch of trials or you need to be certified to do this. I'm like, the lady in the middle of the Amazon would laugh at our lab coats and beakers. You know, they've been using this stuff for decades. Yeah. So Hank, we can always use donations, man. But yeah, nofallenheroes.com or our Instagram page or even our YouTube channel has some great interviews with our veterans and first responders who have sat with the medicine. And let me be clear. So it's work. If you come home and you don't change patterns and behaviors, you can have some low points as well. This is not a quick fix. It ain't a Band-Aid. It's work to do this. Yeah. But if you put in the work, it's potentially life-saving and changing. So keep that in mind. So final plug there would be, if you're a civilian and you're interested in this, please reach out to us because maybe you can help sponsor somebody. Shoot me an email, whiz@nofallenheroes.com. And I'd love to talk to you.
Well, keep up the great work.
Yeah.
It's awesome to see your passion for it and also how it changed your life.
And you got to come out to Aspen next year, man. Let's bend you in the airplane.
I'm in. Can we talk a little bit about call signs to end the show? I know it's a little bit of a hot button topic, but where'd you get Wiz?
Yeah. So let me start with, there's no Maverick or Iceman running around in the Air Force or Navy, maybe in the Marine Corps.
Right.
Too cool, man. You earn your call sign, and it's usually by doing something incredibly stupid. Well, here's the funny part. If you need extra flight time, you can grab a Hornet and go get some extra hours. And of course, you take the jet home. But your name is only on the side of a jet. That's not your jet, because if it's broken, the engines are bad for a year, you're not flying. So you just get your name on a jet. But if you're taking the jet home to see your folks, you bring some beers to the maintenance guys like, hey, can I get the one with my name on it to come home? So I'd fly into, Atlantic City International, and my parents would bring all their friends out. And on one side of the jet is my dad and his buddies, and the other side of the jet's my mom with her friends. And my mom would be like, his call sign's Wiz because he's brilliant. My dad's on the other side, like, his call sign's Wiz because he pissed all over his commanding officer one night when he was drunk. So I'll stick with my mom's story.
My dad
was a well-known exaggerator.
Yeah, mom's always right. Or what's the most embarrassing call sign for one of your colleagues? And the story behind the name.
As a family show, I will take the Fifth Amendment.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah. But before I go, because Hank, I know you're a hoodie guy.
Oh, yeah.
Here is a psychedelic fighter pilot hoodie.
Oh, I love that one.
That's great.
And then on the sleeve, before we do anything, we count down. Before you do an air-to-air engagement, 3, 2, 1, fights on. And then, so that's his psychedelic fighter pilot. And then the psychedelic fighter pilot t-shirt.
Thanks,
man.
Wiz.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Yeah, no, it's great. And I hope you get to enjoy the afternoon here with wife. 30 years before you head back to Florida.
Tomorrow. We went to the Rangers game last night, and I'm glad they handed out beanies.
Oh, nice.
Because I flew up from Boca, man, and it's snowing. I brought your first snowstorm of the year, so thanks for the beanies to the Rangers.
Nice. Another hat to your collection.
Oh, sweet.
There's Club 30 gear.
That goes with my flight suit.
Gold and black. Yeah, thanks for one of your service to our country, and thanks for all you're doing today. It's really, really amazing.
Yeah,
proud to know you.
It doesn't get any better than trying to help save and change other people's lives. So thanks for helping me spread the word. I appreciate it, fellas.
Yeah.
Thanks, Wiz.
Thanks, Wiz.
Thanks for having me.
What'd you think, Hank?
First off, a big thank you to Matthew Buckley. That was very interesting, inspiring as well. I just love the stories getting into, you know, flying for the Navy, what's required and the challenges that comes with it.
Yeah, fascinating guy. Such great energy too. Like, you can just imagine just posting up at a bar and listening him tell flying stories for hours.
That's what we did the first time we met at the charity event. Yeah. So many great stories. But yeah, no, there's a lot, you know, listening to someone that's been part of the Navy military, think about the bonds you create also through team sports and team first mentality always.
Yeah.
There's so many similarities, even though they take it to the next level because the consequences are obviously so much higher.
Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons why I always love the team building exercises we've had through the military.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. What struck me, I think, was just like what kind of sacrifice it takes to serve this country, you know, for all the men and women of the armed forces. Like, it's just, you know, obviously the exciting part of, you know, the telling flying stories is one thing, but what it leaves you with to deal with after that, you know, transition into civilian life is...
And our first responders.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it just really struck me what amazing like responsibility to yourself and to your family you have afterwards. You know, it must be just a crazy transition.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad and was interested to hear about like what Wiz was doing, you know, like what a great way to give back.
Yep. No, there's a lot of people out there that need help. So. Yeah. Keep up the great work.
Yeah. What a great conversation. Thanks for bringing him on. That was,
it was great. I look forward to, you know, stay in touch with him. Yeah. And you know, I have my shot going up in the plane. Maybe next time you get that opportunity.
Fingers crossed. I mean, that would be a dream come true for me. But
I hope you guys enjoyed that show, guys. I definitely did.
Yeah. Loved it. Thanks to Wiz. That was an incredible hour together. And I hope you guys at Club 30 liked it too. We'd love to have you as subscribers, so give a thumbs up, subscription. We'd appreciate anybody that wants to follow along on the Club 30 journey.
Let's do it. See you guys next week.
Next week.